So yeah, I loved it. And I wanted to play baseball, but that didn't work out. So I tried out for a play, and that changed my
life. That stuck. Yeah. So instead of a double play, you're just doing single plays, is what you're saying.
There you go.
So,
there you go.
Hello, welcome to the Journal Beat, the podcast from your friends at the City Journals and the Davis Journal newspapers. I'm your host, Tom Haraldson. Each week, we're going to visit with newsmakers, entertainers, writers, and those personalities that touch our lives. And today, I'm really excited because in the studio with us is Michael Flynn, famous Michael Flynn.
Oh, yeah, that's me.
Absolutely. Actor, producer, director, screenwriter. I tell people that they may not recognize your name, but and we will be posting photos, but they certainly will recognize your face because your credits are amazing, and I really appreciate you doing this.
Wow, that's very kind of you.
In being here. So I did a little research, as we always do before we do the shows, and I found out that if you'd had your druthers, you and I would have had a very similar desire when we were young, which was to play baseball.
That's true.
Tell me about that.
I grew up on the East Coast, you know, back in the 50s, early 60s, that's when I was a kid, and a huge baseball fan from New England originally. And, you know, my dad and grandparents, my uncle Edgar played college ball. My dad played a little bit of college ball. So anyway, I just loved baseball. Big Yankee fan, Mickey, you know, Roger Maris and all
Whitey,
those
Whitey
guys.
Ford?
Whitey Ford, Tony Kubek, Bobby Richardson, Elston Howard. Yogi Berra, of course.
Yeah, all the 60s Yankees that beat my Giants in 1962.
Exactly. They beat everybody.
They did. That's true.
So, yeah, I loved it. And I wanted to play baseball, but that didn't work out. So I tried out for a play, and that changed my
that
life.
That stuck. Yeah. So instead of a double play, you're just doing single plays, is what you're saying. So,
there you go.
What was your position? What did you want to play in baseball?
Second base.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was kind of a Bobby Richardson fan, and so I wanted to play second base.
We could talk for hours about the 62 World Series, but we won't. And I was only 9, but it was still sad. So did it happen in junior high, high school? When did you get your first part?
I was a sophomore in high school. And I think I missed the bus or something, so I was late wandering around the school. And so it was George City Marshall High School just outside Washington, D.C. And the guy directing the play, John Reese, wandered into the hall and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Nothing. Just waiting for the bus." He said, "Why don't you come in and try out for this play I'm doing?" I said, "I've never done that before." He says, "I don't care." So I thought, well, all right. So I did. I got a small part. And I thought, I can do this. Yeah, this resonates with me.
Sure. What was it that attracted you to it? What did you like about it?
I don't know. It just resonated with me. You know, I thought, I can do this. Yeah, I get this. And the next year, my junior year, things kind of took off, and my senior year, was great, leading roles in everything. And
wow.
And I went to college, got leading roles and all that kind of stuff, even as a freshman.
Yeah.
My freshman year was at the Richmond Professional Institute in Richmond, Virginia.
Wow.
And they had a professional acting program there. And then I went on a mission.
Ah, where did you go?
I went to France.
Ah, parlez-vous français?
Ben oui, je parle français.
We'll do the whole podcast in French from now on.
Hey, there you go.
Just kidding. How did that, I would think the acting, being able to speak, narratively for people, that probably would be a great training for somebody becoming a missionary.
I think so. I picked up the French language quite quickly. When I was a small kid, I lived for 3 years on the island of Cyprus, and they speak Greek over there. And so even as a small kid, we had a Greek-speaking maid who didn't speak English, and so she was teaching us Greek, and so I picked up some of that stuff, still remember a little bit of it. I don't know, maybe something just clicked in my head or something, but French was pretty easy to pick up for me.
The nice thing about that, though, as an actor, you have no compunction about being in front of people.
No, that didn't bother
me. And talking, so knocking on doors probably wasn't so bad either.
Knocking on doors was a little freaky because, well, at first I didn't speak French very well at all. And I'd only been a member of the LDS Church for a little over a year.
Ah.
And then I find myself in northwestern France knocking on doors. And,
wow.
And trying to talk to people about religion, about which I knew very little. So,
sure.
So It was a great experience, though.
Yeah.
It was a 2.5 year mission.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, 30 months.
Yeah.
Late 60s, is that when that was?
Yeah, 66 to 69.
Oh, wow. Wow. World was a different place then.
Oh, yeah. That's France was a different place. Paris was very different.
Yeah.
It was ugly and dirty and fabulous. much better than the Paris today.
This is from a guy who wanted to play baseball in New York, folks. So New York is probably that way a little bit as well. Going to fast forward ahead, we'll talk about all the things you've done. But today, you mentioned you're living in Utah County.
Yeah.
I read that you and your wife have, between the two of you, 13 children.
That's correct.
And 40 grandchildren?
46, I think.
46. Yeah. Holy smokes.
You got some old news there, Tom.
I do. Well, you know, it's you know, what can I say? It's Wikipedia. So, and I can't imagine the birthday budget you have to have.
Well, it's crazy. We don't really have a birthday budget because we just told the kids, you might get a card.
I need to adopt that. So, I also understand you're you love racquetball.
I do.
Right.
Very avid racquetball player.
Yeah. Play pickleball?
A little bit, but pickleball is kind of for sissies. So I'm not around.
I just took pickleball. Don't say stuff to me.
I'm kidding. No, pickleball is a great sport. Yeah. I can't get used to the paddle and the slow pace of it kind of bugs
right.
me. So racquetball is a lot faster.
It is. Do you know Kurt Bester?
I do. I've never played racquetball.
He's quite the racquetball player.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
I'll have to ask him about
that. I've been in a racquetball court with him, and I say I've been on it. I wasn't on it very well, but I was on it for briefly, so that was kind of cool. All right, let's talk about your film history here. And okay. In the second half, we're going to talk about a film that you and I were in together that you had no idea we were in together until I told you the other day. But your part was better than mine. You actually spoke. But,
yes.
What drew you to your first movie? I know the first movie that you were in was called Savannah Smiles.
Correct.
And it's a classic, very popular movie amongst the people here in Utah.
Yeah.
And you played a police officer.
I did.
And we'll talk about the second police officer you played in a minute. But
the first of many police officers, cops.
How did that come about for you?
Detectives. When I got out of college, I was a stage actor. And I did that for about 8 years. Mostly musicals. And I toured all over the country with various musical producing, directing, acting, that kind of thing.
Do you sing?
I sing in musicals, but I'm not a legitimate singer. I could never play Jean Valjean or anything like that. Oh. But there's a lot of musicals for men that you don't have to have this great singing voice. And I've been fortunate to play some of the iconic roles in musical theater. So it's been fun. But anyway, so I did that for about 7 or 8 years. And then I moved to Utah in 1980, and a friend of mine offered me a job here producing, directing musicals and stuff like that. And I kind of got tired of that. I mean, it was fine, but I got tired of that. I did that for a few more years after I got to Utah. But when I landed here in 1980, I realized that in Utah, they actually make movies.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I want to do that. So I immediately got an agent. I was fortunate to get one immediately. And then I just started auditioning for stuff.
Wow. And Savannah Smiles, how did that happen for you?
I don't really remember. I had an agent, so I'm assuming that my agent sent me an audition notice. And I went in. This is back in the day when you actually went in. This is long before self-tapes and all that
sure.
kind of stuff. So I'm sure I just went into an audition. And I noticed that when I was talking to the director, that I said, I'm thinking this guy is French because he had an accent. So I said, so are you French? He goes, yeah. And so I started talking to him in French.
Wow.
And my French is actually pretty good. The accent's really good. And so he was kind of impressed that an American kid walks in and starts speaking French to him. So I don't know if that was it, but yeah, I got just a nice little role in Savannah Smiles.
How long were you on screen? What did the role contain?
I was in probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 scenes total. And I had kind of an all-star cast and some for that day.
Right.
And I didn't really realize how fortunate I was at the time. That was my first movie. I thought, oh, it's always like this.
Sure.
And when we broke for lunch the first day, I think, well, they're going to bring in, you know, McDonald's in a bag or something. Know. But no, they blocked off the street. They had like 6 or 8 tables full of every kind of food possible. And I'm thinking, wow, I could get in there. You have your own dressing room, your name on the door. I thought, You know, it was very strange for a stage actor. And I thought, yeah, I can get used to this. So that was the first.
We'll talk a little about my experiences as an extra, but I never got paid for anything much except for craft services.
Yeah.
That was enough.
Yeah, there you go.
And it got better, of course, as the years went on. I want to read a couple of quotes, again, I found on, I think this was IMDb that you mentioned. I'd love to talk to you about these.
Okay.
One is, acting is all about the passion. Nothing else matters. If you can't find the passion in what you're doing, you shouldn't be doing it. Acting is not real life. It's real life on steroids. Love that one. Audiences are not interested in the mundane. They come to see the passion. Talk about passion.
Let's see, how do I address that? In life, we tend to suppress the passion a lot of times. We tend to operate out of our heads, you know, and the mind pretty much controls the gut. And the gut wants to do all these crazy things, wants to do all these wonderful things. And the mind is saying, nah, you don't want to do that. That's embarrassing. You're going to fool yourself. That's stupid. But in film, as a general rule, we are driven by our gut and our instincts. And the nice thing about film, and there's some difference between film and stage, obviously, but in film, I tell actors when I'm directing or doing my workshop, I say, if your gut is telling you to do something, then do it. And then if it doesn't work, we do take two.
Sure.
And so that, I think that's a big part of the passion, is finding actors who can deal with letting down their walls and letting us see inside, because we're not interested in the exterior. You know, when you look around at people in general, you can see, you go to the gas station or you go to a Costco or something like that, and you see people walking around, and I'm always observing people. And you can tell just from the outside, you get a feeling for who they are, what they are, okay? What their personality might be like, not even talking to them. And then sometimes when you talk to them, you know, you think, I'm a pretty cool person or whatever. But what we're really interested in film is to dig way down deep. And when you see the interesting performances in film, television, that kind of thing, what we're really seeing is we're seeing the inside of the actor. Because every role really that actors play, I think whether they acknowledge it or not, is really inside them. And that's the trick. You find what's inside you that relates to this particular character. And so it's a three-step process. First, you have to acknowledge that, yeah, I can be that person. I am that person. Might be a really ugly person. Could be a horrible, horrible, disgusting person. So you find this horrible, horrible, disgusting person inside you. And there's one in every one of us. But the thing is, the brain doesn't let it out.
Right.
And we kind of suppress it, maybe to the point where it almost disappears, which is fine in real life. But not in film. So in film, we find this ugly person. That's the first thing. And then we have the courage to let this person out. But then we have to have the talent and the gift of letting this passion out in a way that works on film. I didn't really explain it too well. But it's, you know, acting is an interesting thing. I tell actors, I have this workshop that I do in Salt Lake where I work with actors every
month. Yeah, we're going to talk about your actor's workshop. I'm very interested in hearing about that.
Okay, so. Cool. But I tell actors all the time, because we get asked, okay, what does an actor do? And sometimes they say, well, do you have to wear makeup? And I say, yeah, I have to wear makeup. Isn't that weird? No, it's not weird. They say, what do actors do? And they try to... Some actors will say, I want to become this character. I see this character. He's kind of like my Uncle Bob or my Aunt Susie. And I want to be that. And I want to wear a certain pair of shoes and put on a certain hat. That's all a bunch of garbage. You know, it's silliness. Really, as actors, what we do is we listen, which is a huge part of it. We listen and then we react to that. And we have to listen very carefully to what the other people are doing in the scene. We listen to their voice. We watch their eyes, which is another way of listening. Body language. What kind of energy are they giving me? And it's the other. And it's an actor's responsibility to give a certain amount of energy to the actors in the scene that they're doing.
Right.
That they're doing. And
when you're on stage, in particular, and your lines are being cued off of somebody else's lines, and if they don't say the line right or they forget their line, that cue isn't there, and the ability to kind of ad-lib and get through that without that coming, knowing that much about the script, that's got to be a challenge.
Yeah.
And again, on stage, you can't stop and roll over again.
Yeah, so. it's uh, Yeah, it is. You know, it's like I say, film, you know, we take a lot of more liberties in film than we do on stage.
Sure.
Because like I say, we can always, cut, we're going to try that again.
Right.
And actors can forget their lines in film. It's not a big deal. We'll go back to one, do it again. But I forgot what your question was.
Oh, well, no, just that, you know, the ability to, I did some stage acting in high school. And I, you know, I know there's only one reason why you've actually never casted me in a movie. Do you know what that is?
No.
I can't act, but
no, there, you go.
There you go. That's a big part. But I do remember having to say a line and the person that was supposed to respond to that couldn't because I'd forgotten the line. And you kind of stand, this is high school, kind of standing there looking at each other and being silly. But, you know, one thing, one other quote, and then we're going to take a break and talk about some other things here. But I love this quote. It kind of ties in with what you just said. In all of us, there's a saint and a sinner.
Yeah.
A pope and a prostitute. Right.
Right.
The actor's work is to find the person within. It's not a coat we put on. It's to find the person and let him out.
Yeah.
When you were trying for a lead as somebody who was counterintuitive to who you are off camera, were you obsessed with that? Did you stay in that character for the entire week or two or however long you were making that film?
No, I don't.
Were you able to separate it?
I don't work that way.
Yeah.
I think some actors do, you know, they get into what you know, call the method.
Right.
System,
method. Yeah.
And they want to be that person. You know, when the director says cut, they're still that person. They're that person when they're eating lunch and
right.
all that kind of stuff. Me personally, I don't work that way.
That's great. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about May of 1983, which was a month that kind of changed my life, and it's where we first met. We'll come back with Michael Flynn more on the Journal Beat right after this. And we're back on Journal Beat with Michael Flynn, famous actor, director, producer, screenwriter.
Hello, hello.
All around nice guy. So May 1983, a memorable month for people here in Utah. That was the year of the floods.
Yeah.
There was the bridge over 13th East or 13th South when you wanted to go. But more importantly for some of us, that's when I decided I was going to become an extra.
Ah.
So I do not remember the name of the gal. I want to say it was Kate. Somebody, but
Pergastus,
might have been Kate Pergastus. But anyway, somehow I was told about a movie they were going to film in Payson at Payson High School. They gave me the names of a couple of the people who were in it. I'd never heard of either one of them. And they said, well, wait, anyway, they needed some people to walk around in the cafeteria behind the two actors that were on screen. And so in the very, very famous cameo appearance of my right hip in the movie Footloose, I was within 20 feet of Kevin Bacon and Chris Penn. But that was, as we joked about one time, that was my first movie, quote unquote, but it was your second movie.
Right.
Tell me about Footloose.
Okay. I don't remember auditioning for it. I don't remember anything about that part of it. I'm sure I did audition. Actually, I worked with a casting director, Marcy Leeroff, and she's kind of a well-known casting director in L.A., and I brought her in to do some stuff in my workshop. And I had noticed in her curriculum vitae that she had cast Footloose. And I said, well, I was in Footloose. She said, I know. She said, I cast you in that. I said, well, okay, cool. I don't remember that. Anyway, I auditioned for it, obviously. I don't remember the audition. And again, this was very early in my career, and I read the script. This was back in the day. They actually let us read the script. They don't do that anymore for some reason. So I read the whole script, and I thought, this is the stupidest movie I've ever read in my life.
Oh, it got panned pretty good by the critics. Roger Ebert hated it.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that. And so they started burning books and stuff, and I thought, this is kind of, I mean, well, come on. But then, you know, they wanted me to be in it and said, oh, sure. I think the most interesting thing about Footloose for me was a couple of things. Remember, I think it was the first day I was shooting with Kevin Bacon, Chris Penn, and the gang, and we broke for lunch. And I'm dressed as a cop,
right?
Obviously. So I'm sitting at the lunch table, and Kevin is across from me, next to me, something like that. And he says, well, Michael, I'm really glad you're an actor and not a real cop. Because traditionally, sometimes when they make movies, they would actually get the real lawyer, the real cop, sure. the real whatever. Mm. And as a general rule, that does not work out well. And so I'm playing this cop. And there was a scene, somewhat of an iconic scene for some reason. I don't know why. But so I pull Kevin Bacon out of his car.
Yeah.
He and Chris Penn were running around. And Russ McGinn was in the scene with me. He was the other cop. And Russ McGinn is about 6'8".
Wow.
Okay. And who was the director of Footloose? Ross. Anyway, great director, big time director, A-list director. And so on the side of the big Panavision 35 millimeter things they had back then, there was two pieces of tape because he kept confusing me and Russ.
Really?
Yeah, calling me Russ, calling him Michael. And then he finally got it getting it right. And so on the side of the big Panavision thing, the two pieces of white tape, it said Russ tall, Michael less tall. And I thought, well, that's very politically correct
in 1980s.
Yeah. So anyway, so I yanked Kevin Bacon out of the car and I'm kind of pushing him around a little bit and he starts mouthing off. He had handed me his driver's license.
Right.
And just a gut reaction on my part, I flipped him under the chin with his driver's license. Somebody, you know, you don't mouth off to me, boy, or something like that. I don't know what I said. And for some reason, that became this iconic moment in Footloose of me flipping Kevin Bacon under the chin. So when they did the remake, it's still in there.
Really?
And then when I saw the musical, it's in the musical, but it wasn't in the script.
Interesting.
It wasn't in the script at all. It was just something that, like I said earlier, we rely on our instincts, and I didn't even think about it. I just popped him under the chin,
right.
Surprised him, and there it is.
There you go.
That's the most interesting thing about Footloose to me. It's kind of a letdown because it's not that interesting, but...
But
it was fun.
Classic scene.
Herb Ross, that was the name
of it. Herb Ross,
how could I forget that? And so anyway, yeah, so... And I didn't think the movie was going to amount to anything. And nobody knew Kevin Bacon. No. Nobody knew Chris Penn.
Do you know who originally they wanted for that part?
What's that?
Do you know who they wanted that part for Kevin?
I don't know.
Tom Cruise.
Oh, really?
And he was tied in doing Risky Business.
Huh?
And he couldn't break it. So
I think Kevin Bacon would have been a much better choice, but
yeah.
I'm sure Tom Cruise would have been great.
Yeah.
He's a great actor.
But, you know, what a break for Kevin.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, when we talked about doing this podcast, I mentioned... you know, on April 20th, he's agreed to come back to Payson High School.
Yeah.
40th anniversary of the release.
Yeah, I think that's
release.
Really cool. They're going to do that.
They're going to tear the school down. They have, according to the show I saw, the episode of the Today Show I saw, it's a shrine to Kevin Bacon. His locker's untouched. They have posters all over the school.
Really?
And this was the year of Footloose at Payson High School.
That's
so,
funny.
And I mention that because there's a possibility in talking to some of the people with the film commission that they're going to have people who were involved in that film be brought down there. So
I heard something about that.
Yeah.
So it would be fun. I've not seen him since then.
Right.
So it'd be fun to say, hey, Kevin.
Yeah.
And flip him under the chin and see what happens.
I've never seen him. I say, hey, now I can close the 6 degree thing and my wife can get off my case for always mentioning it. So
there you go.
I want to talk about some of the movies that you've starred in, written, directed, cast, probably ran your own camera for all I know.
Some classics.
Some of the older ones that I looked up last night. Well, let's talk about Matlock. First of all, I heard you were on Matlock.
Yeah.
What part was that?
Let's see. What was I in Matlock? I was...
Were you a cop?
No, I was a... I don't know what I was, but it was the only thing interesting about the Matlock deal was I was newly in L.A., kind of a roundabout way. I actually moved to LA in 1987, 88, and that's when I did Matlock. And I think Matlock was the first or second gig I got down there. I was in Moonlighting. I don't know if you remember Moonlighting.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So I was in Moonlighting, Matlock, did a movie in Georgia, and then the actors went on strike, or the writers went on strike, something like that, and everything shut down. I moved back to Utah and anything. Anyway, but Matlock... It was one of those deals. You remember when the 900 number was popular?
Oh, sure.
Popular?
Yeah.
So Matlock took advantage of that. And so somebody, I think, it was a long time ago, Tom. And I'm not sure I ever even watched the episode. But anyway, there were three of us. So me and another guy and a girl. And somebody got murdered. And
what? Murder on Matlock? How could that be?
And so the three of us were all suspects. I could have done it. She could have done it. The other guy could have done it. Then they had a 900 to call in at the end and vote for who killed whom.
Really?
Yeah. And so we had three different endings to that particular episode.
Was there a prize if you guessed it? Or
I have no idea.
That's
I have no idea.
Did you win? Were you the one that did it?
I don't even know that, to be honest
with
you.
Wow.
But it was fun. You know, it was, again, it was like my first or second time doing a big network TV show. And it's kind of they just churn them out, you know. This is not Hamlet, okay? So
I want to talk about, I also mentioned in the list here, you know, you were an episode of Yellowstone, but you mentioned during the break that you've also been in Horizons.
Yeah,
Kevin Costner
summer, June, July, something like that, for about 3 weeks.
I think those two come out back to back this June and in August.
I think so.
Yeah. What was that like?
It was fun, you know? I mean, when you do a big show like that, they pay you really well. They take really good care of you. Had a great hotel room, lots of great food, unfortunately, and really nice people to work with. And met some really cool people, made some good friends. Was there for about 3 weeks,
Wow. Costner's announced he's going to build a big studio down in St. George.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Which is a big investment. I want to talk about a movie that you filmed here in Salt Lake, part of it in Salt Lake at least, called Evil in Clear River.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
And I've teased you about this before because I was always envious because when that movie came out, this was a big deal. But in that movie, you actually got to kiss Lindsay Wagner,
the bionic woman.
I
kissed her several times, and we were in bed together, so it was great.
Wow, 12 takes for the kissing?
Absolutely.
Craig Clyde was in that one. I think Randy Quaid had a part in that.
Yeah, he was kind of the antagonist.
Do you remember the name of Lindsay Wagner's character?
Kate, I believe.
Kate McKinnon.
Yes.
How humorous is that?
Yeah, that's interesting.
The way that kind of goes. In that sense, let's talk about some of the movies that you've made the best 2 years.
Right.
The Dance.
Right.
And Who We Are.
Right.
Chat about those a little bit.
Okay. Best 2 years. Best 2 years started as a play in the early 80s, like 81, something like that. That's when I met Scott Anderson, who was the writer-director of Best 2 years. And he and I became fast friends, and I got involved with the play early on. I would not do originally, but then I got involved with it. And then that kind of, you know, petered out in the mid-80s. And then fast forward to the early 2000s when LDS films started to catch on with God's Army and Singles Ward and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Don't forget Church Ball. I was an extra in that one.
Yeah, I'd like to forget that. Anyway, just kidding. Anyway, so I called Scott. I said, Scott, I remember this very distinctly. I said, you know, we need to make a movie of the best 2 years. And he's, well, I'm busy with this, that, and the other thing. I know. Come on, dude. Let's make a movie of it. No, I don't want to do that. I kept pestering him about it. And so it took a couple of years, I think, if my memory is correct. He finally said, okay, fine. Well, I'll start working on the screenplay. Michael, you start raising money. So, yeah, that's always fun. So I had a video of the play that we did at Promise Valley Playhouse. And so I took this VHS tape, that's all I had, and I started talking to people. And here's the reaction I got. So Michael, you want to do a movie about four LDS missionaries in Holland? Yeah. Yeah, that isn't even remotely interesting to me. And I talked to this one guy, he had tons of money, and he's into storage units. And he said, well, this looks kind of interesting, but for the same amount of money you're asking for, I could build another storage unit. I said, okay, well, build a storage unit. You know, build another parking lot. Yeah. What are you going to do? And finally, I mean, I talked to a lot of people. I just had flat, turned down nothing.
Wow.
Finally, one of my neighbors, I was living in Alpine at the time, and he said, well, that sounds interesting. So why don't you bring it over and we'll throw it on the big screen in my basement. So I did. And the quality of the VHS tape was horrible. But the tone and flavor and humor and, you know, and the pathos, whatever, of Best 2 years comes through in the play, even as stupid as the video was. He says, I think this will make a great film. And he said, well, let me put in some Our budget was about $500,000, $550,000 for that, which you would never do that today. But anyway, he said, well, let me put in $100,000 and we'll see. And well, I'll help you raise the rest of the money. I'm thinking, okay. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking, we're never going to raise the rest of the money. So as time went on, he ended up funding the whole thing.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we cast the show here. I played the mission president in it. Do you remember the guy by the name of Gordon Jump?
Oh, sure.
Well, yeah. Gordon is a good buddy of mine. We did some stuff together and toured around with a couple of shows. It was that we had some musicals. And then he was in, he played Scrooge in A Christmas Carol in Salt Lake. And I was Marley to his Scrooge and stuff like that.
Also the Maytag repairman for many years.
Yeah, well, he got well taken care of.
He did.
So anyway, so I called Gordon. I said, Gordon, here's this movie we're going to do it, and the mission president is a perfect role for you. And he said, I would love it. So we sent him the script. He loved it. But his doctor wouldn't let him go overseas.
Oh, wow.
And then he died not too long after that.
Right.
And I had fun playing the mission president. I mean, a monkey could have done that role. but Gordon would have brought some very nice humor to it. And it would have been great for my dear friend to have that, what has become, iconic LDS movie, kind of the last thing he did. And so I feel bad that he wasn't, as much as I enjoyed doing it, I feel bad that he didn't. But anyway, we went to Holland. We took 18 people to Holland for 2 weeks. Came back here, rehearsed for a week, and then shot for two more weeks here. All the interiors of Best of Years were shot here in Utah.
Oh, wow.
All the exteriors and some of the interiors were shot over there. The missionary apartment, everything was shot here.
Wow.
And it was a great experience, a lot of fun.
Talk about Who We Are.
Passion project of mine. I thought about it for maybe 10, 12 years. And I started working on the script, and it took me about 3 years, maybe more, to fine-tune the script. It was just a story I wanted to tell. To be truthful, Tom, I got really tired of all of the sugar-coated, silly, nonsensical films that the LDS public was subject to.
Like Church Ball, the one I was in.
Well, yes. Home Teachers, Church Ball, kind of stuff, Singles Ward 2, and the list goes on. And, I didn't like them. I was in some of them, unfortunately. And I was, and the people are nice and you love working with them, but come on, really? And so I had this idea. I wanted to write a film about five or six LDS kids in a cabin for a couple of days and they let it all hang out. And so I did, and nothing happened. Took forever to raise the money. Very small budget film, but it was designed that way. I won't get into that, but anyway, finally put enough money together to shoot it.
Was it filmed here?
Yeah, we shot at a cabin up at Sundance. And had a great cast and a great crew, and we had an absolute blast doing it. One of the things we did differently with that is very unusual in the film industry is we rehearsed for 2 weeks in my basement.
Wow.
And so when we got on set, the actors knew all their lines for the entire film, which is very unusual, if not, it never happens. And it just went so smoothly.
Wow.
And me personally, I think it's the best thing I've ever done. People ask me, what's your favorite film? I say, well, Who We Are. But you're not even in it. Right. But I wrote and directed it and produced it. And it's very, very near and dear to my heart. Had a distributor, finally, Covenant, decided that they would distribute it. And so I said, okay. So we signed up with them and they did less than nothing with the film.
Which is really sad.
And
I watched it and I liked it.
Oh, good.
It was a great film.
Yeah, I think it is a good film.
Absolutely.
But, it deals with different topics, sure. As you know.
Well, and not everybody's cookie cutter stereotype LDS kid either, which I liked. They all had pasts or histories or whatever.
They were all different. And I had to tame it down a little bit. In the original version, there was a little bit of language. I mean, very little. But coming and said, oh, we can't. Mormons can't handle that. I said, well, I guarantee you that 90% of the active Mormons have used those words in the last week.
They'll totally relate to it. Yeah.
And that's one of the things that frustrates me about the entertainment arena, for the LDS Church, of which I'm an active member, is that, they limit themselves so much. We can't talk about that.
Right.
We don't want. If we talk about homosexuality, then all of our kids are going to be gay. Really? Well, if you talk about drug addiction, then all my kids are going to be addicted to drugs. If we talk about pornography, they're all going to be unborn. And on and on. And one of the characters in that film is, had a baby when she was 16,
right.
15 actually. And my daughter's going to go get pregnant because of that character in the film. I said, what are you out of your freaking mind?
Yeah.
I mean, they talk about most of this stuff in general conference.
Of course.
But we can't talk about it in a movie.
No.
So, very frustrating. But anyway,
absolutely.
I think it's a nice film. In the lexicon of LDS film, I think it ranks right up there at the top.
Where can people find it still?
I have no idea.
Okay. I mean, is it available?
It's available on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
Under the title of Faith, Hope, Love.
Okay.
Because I had to get a different distributor to actually get it on Amazon Prime.
Wow.
That's what a lame piece of garbage Covenant was.
Right.
They're horrible.
Yeah, I've heard horror stories.
No, they're horrible. They were terrible. They were terrible about it.
Favorite actor?
My favorite actor?
Yeah. Maybe a famous actor you've either worked with or directed or just watched.
Oh, there's so many of them. Yeah, I mean, there's so many good actors. I mean, you take the list of, you mentioned Tom Cruise. He's great. You mentioned Brad Pitt. He's a great actor. The list goes on. There's no way to pick a favorite actor. But some of the favorite films, Peter O'Toole is one of my favorite actors. And one of my favorite films is The Lion in Winter, 1968, with Katharine Hepburn. They're both nominated for Best Actor. She actually won. She tied with Barbara Streisand.
Yeah, that's right. The first tie, I think.
I think it was the first.
Yeah.
And so, but that's the kind of film I like. I'm not into sci-fi. I'm not into fantasy. I'm not into, the car chase stuff at all. Bores me to tears.
Yeah.
I'd much rather watch a film like Pieces of April. I don't know if you're familiar with that. A very simple film shot on a handy cam, I think, the Sony handy cam.
Wow.
Great cast, great story, fabulous film. There's another one called Blue something, something blue. What was it? Anyway, it's a very simple story about two people. They were high school sweethearts, and they haven't seen each other in like 25 years.
Oh, I know the movie you're talking about. And I just can't think of what it's
Blue
called.
Blue Jay, that's what it is. They shot it in like 5 days,
yeah.
and all in one house, pretty much. And see, those kind of movies, I'm all
sure.
Over.
I could talk for hours about movie making, and we have a great conversation, you and me, along for the podcast. But let's talk about the actor's workshop, because I know that's something that you're involved with now. And what else are you doing now besides that? Let's talk about that first of all. Actor's workshop.
Yeah, I love the actor. The actor's workshop, fantastic. I started working with actors probably in the 80s. And I was with the McCarty Agency, and Susie McCarty, dear friend, she said, Mike, you're doing all this film. Why don't you come in and work with some of the actors? And I said, sure. So I'd go in once in a while and do a 1 or 2 week workshop with some of the McCarty actors. But it was kind of hit and miss. And then I started, so I would rent a room here and there. I'd get a place. But about 11, 12 years ago, I thought, I'm going to take it to the next level. And so I found a studio in Salt Lake on Foothill Drive and Foothill Village over there. And over the years, I've improved it, upgraded everything. And the way it works now, Tom, is I'll have some actors come in at the beginning of the month. And I like to work with about 8 to 10 actors, sometimes 12. 8 is kind of the cutoff, on the low end. But I do it differently than most people. In that they come in probably the first night or so, we work on either a monologue or some self-tapes, that kind of thing. But then we work on scene work. And I pair the actors and I assign scenes to them. and they schedule when they want to come in for it. They come in, we set aside 3 or 4 hours to work on each scene. We rehearse, I direct the scene, I shoot the scene, and then I edit the scene. And then for our final session, everybody gets back together, and I bring in a panel of casting directors, agents, that kind of thing, and I screen all their work for the casting directors and the agents. And they get feedback, they're able to talk to them and go back and forth. A lot of people don't realize that, first of all, a casting director doesn't cast anything. They're simply a roadblock. In other words, the casting director fields all the self-tapes. They watch all the self-tapes, and then they decide what they send on
to forward
to LA or whatever. Okay. And so you got to get through them. Your first roadblock really is your agent.
Sure.
Your agent has to send you out for it. And then you do your self-tape, you submit it to the casting director, and then they decide. They might have 100, 150, 80, whatever, people auditioning for a particular role. So they sift through that, and they have to send maybe 4 or 5 on to L.A. So that you really, there's a real paring down
sure.
of the process. But in the actors' workshop, that's what we do. It's very popular with the local actors, and have a lot of success with it. I'm very passionate about it and really love working with actors.
Where can they get more information about that?
Probably the best way is just to look it up on Facebook, the Actors Workshop.
Okay.
Yeah, they'll find it.
Yeah. Got any other movies you're working on right now?
Yeah, I'm working on, I have a kind of a relationship with a distributor called Bridgestone Media Group, and they distributed, they've distributed 3 films for me so far, and they're excited about this new one that I'm working on. And they're very conservative. They have a kind of a Christian side to them. And they're a great distributor, especially when compared to Covenant or something like that.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
You familiar with Angel Studios?
Pardon?
You familiar with Angel
Studios? Yeah, I'm familiar with them, yeah.
I just saw a film they produced about the Catholic nun that
Cabrini, that's a great film.
Amazing movie.
Fabulous
Loved
film.
It. Loved
yeah.
it.
Yeah, that's the kind of film I enjoy.
That's great. Yeah. Well, this has been thrilling for me, very enjoyable for me to hear you talk about this. We're going to talk more when we're off the mic here, but thank you for being here. Best of luck to you, and we're going to see you in Horizons and maybe some other things coming down the road here pretty
quick. There's always something out there.
Absolutely. Once you find out who you want to be, then you're the next person the next time and the next role, the next person, everything else.
There you go.
But you know who you are, and that's critical. That's one reason we really appreciate your talent. So thank you very much.
Great to see you.
That's it for the Journal Beat podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. Be sure to watch your mailboxes for our next issues of the City Journals and the Davis Journal newspaper, or you can visit our websites online. Remember, when it comes to covering the news that matters in your community, the journals can't be beat. Have a good day.